This is Bad Cop No Donut for the week of May 12th, 2005.
All right, freeze! Police!
Bad Cop No Donut!
Bad, 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 bad.
Cop, 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 cop.
No, 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 no. Donut, 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 donut.
It's under law, and I rule.
With your weekly wrap-up of North American police brutality, misconduct, and corruption, I'm Ron Anisich at CKLN in Toronto. Stay tuned after this week's headlines for an interview with Min-Suk Lee, director of Hogtown, The Politics of Policing, a new documentary which takes a behind-the-scenes look at the Toronto Police Services Board and the 2004 police budget process at City Council. But first, let's take a look at what the police did to us this week. A police officer in Bloomfield, New Mexico, has been arrested after being accused of molesting a child under the age of 13 in his home. The Associated Press reports that Officer Joseph Goodman was charged with 3 counts of sexual contact with a minor last week. The sexual abuse of the child allegedly took place over a 1-year period. The officer, who has resigned from his job, is currently free on bond.
To me, this is very, very sad because we look up to the policemen in the community. You know, they're our role models.
We need our policemen, we trust them, and we hope they do what was right.
A police officer in Baden, Pennsylvania, was sentenced this week to more than 7 years in prison for having sex with a teenage boy who he met online. An Associated Press report says that Officer Kenneth Jones was sentenced on Monday to 7.5 years in prison after he admitted to having sex with a boy who he had met on the internet in shopping mall parking lots as many as 5 times. The 7-year sentence likely came as a relief to the officer, who was facing as many as 40 years imprisonment. After Jones' arrest, the police searched his home and discovered over 500 images of child pornography on his computer. He pleaded guilty to charges of coercion and enticement of a minor and possession of child pornography in February. Jones had been working as an anti-drug officer at a local elementary school at the time of his arrest. A police officer in Everett, Washington, has resigned after being accused of sexual misconduct in an incident last October. The Seattle Times says that Officer Blaine Lasich is accused of forcing a woman to perform a sex act on him in the front seat of his patrol car. Investigators were able to confirm details of the alleged victim's story. Lasich resigned from his job in March and is facing 1 year in prison and a $5,000 fine if he is convicted. A retired police officer in Greece, New York, accused of having sexual contact with a 10-year-old, is having his case sent before a grand jury after waiving a preliminary hearing this week. A report in the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle says that William Clark was charged with 2 counts of first-degree sexual abuse after being accused of having sex with a 10-year-old girl in his home in 2001. A judge has ordered that the man be held in custody until it is determined if he is mentally fit to stand trial. Clark retired from the Greece Police Department in 1997. A police officer in Auburn, Indiana, was charged with sexual misconduct last week after being accused of fondling a 14-year-old girl. The Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette says that Officer Matthew Hartman is accused of climbing through a window in the bedroom of his victim in the middle of the night in October 2004. The officer then knelt by the bed of his victim, rubbing her leg before reaching up underneath her shirt and fondling her. He left through the bedroom window after his victim woke up, yelled at him to stop, and then kicked the officer in the head. The alleged victim was known to the officer. On Friday, he pleaded not guilty to the charge, and a trial has been set for next January. Hartman has been on paid leave since the accusation was made against him last January, and he was placed on unpaid suspension after he was charged last Monday. Hartman was suspended for 5 days without pay in 2002 after he provided alcohol to a minor. He was also suspended for 1 day without pay in 2000 because of a minor traffic accident. A sheriff's deputy in Graham County, Arizona, has been arrested in connection with an apparent homicide. According to the Eastern Arizona Courier, Deputy Abner Upshaw was arrested, along with a 19-year-old male, last week after a body of a man was discovered apparently bludgeoned to death after a fight with the officer and his accomplice. Upshaw has been placed on paid leave pending the results of an investigation. He is free on his own recognizance. A Michigan state trooper was charged on Monday in connection with the April 14th death of a homeless man in Detroit. The Detroit News reports that the man was shot by Trooper Jay Morningstar when he failed to obey commands to stop coming towards the police. The man was not armed. Morningstar has been charged with second-degree murder and manslaughter. State police also have plans to investigate the shooting, and Morningstar is currently on paid leave. A police officer in Grand Blanc, Michigan, has pleaded no contest to stealing money from a motorist at a traffic stop. A report in the Flint Journal says that Officer Manuel Cervantes was sentenced to 6 months of probation after he took money from the wallet of a man who he had stopped for a broken headlight in February 2004. If he completes his probation successfully, the charge against him will be dismissed. Cervantes will also pay an $800 fine, an unspecified amount of restitution to his victim, and perform 50 hours of community service. He was fired from his job in September. He plans to appeal his sentence.
The determination was made based on the evidence that we had available today not to file charges. There was an autopsy today. Certainly, when the report comes in, we'll review that. We'll review any other evidence that comes in. We'll consider all the evidence.
We've already seen in Fresno what 13 officers have shot people. Half the time they didn't have a weapon, they were all found justified.
A police officer in Fresno, California, who was arrested after he killed his brother on Saturday, will not be charged in connection with the incident. KSEE reports that Officer Louis Sanchez was arrested outside of his home when he surrendered to police after shooting his brother inside the apartment. On Saturday, the chief of the Fresno police held a press conference announcing that Sanchez had been arrested on murder charges and fired from his job. On Tuesday, the local district attorney announced that Sanchez would not face charges in the killing. A police officer in San Francisco has resigned after being accused of sexually harassing a woman who had called police for help. KTVU says that Officer Terry Huey was already on probation after being suspended previously over a separate insubordination incident. The harassment accusation comes before the end of his probationary period. Huey would have likely been fired had he not resigned. A police officer in Moreno Valley, California, has been accused by witnesses of beating a 15-year-old shoplifting suspect. A report in the Press Enterprise says that a witness claims the officer, whose name has not been released, struck the teenager several times with the metal object after he had been subdued by the officer during an arrest on April 20th. Almost a dozen witnesses saw the incident. Police launched an investigation after they received complaints, presumably made by some of them. Police say that a photo of the boy taken at the time of his booking showed no injuries, but they also confirm that the boy was taken to hospital for an examination, which is routinely done before booking in cases where an altercation with an officer has occurred. The officer has not been disciplined and remains on active duty. A police officer in Knoxville, Tennessee, was charged last Wednesday with reckless homicide and aggravated assault after he was involved in an accident which killed one person and injured others. According to the Associated Press, on April 18, 2004, Officer Donald McClendon was responding to a reported break-in with his squad car's lights on, but not the siren, when his cruiser struck a car being driven by a man who was driving his nephews to church. The driver of the struck vehicle was killed, and his passengers were both seriously injured. McClendon is now suing the Knoxville Police Department for compensation for injuries he suffered in the crash. He is facing more than 20 years in jail if convicted on all of his charges, and he is currently free on a $1,000 bond. The city has settled a lawsuit with both of the passengers who survived the accident. A police officer in Chattanooga, Tennessee, has been suspended for allegedly harassing a subordinate female police officer. The Chattanooga Times Free Press reports that Officer David Fry has been suspended for 28 days, placed on probation for 1 year, and demoted from lieutenant to sergeant. Fry was found guilty of sending offensive emails to an unidentified victim who is reported to be a recent graduate of the Chattanooga Police Academy. Fry has been the subject of 5 previous investigations, according to Internal Affairs records. All of those were determined to be unfounded. The chief of the Olmsted, Ohio Police Department is being sued for sexual harassment. WKYC reports that the woman who filed the lawsuit is a former dispatcher with the department. She claims in her lawsuit that Chief William Davis harassed her starting in June 2004. In November 2004, the woman was fired after she complained about the harassment. A police officer in the Columbus suburb of Westerville, Ohio, is now facing 27 charges relating to providing alcohol to minors and showing them pornographic materials. According to an Associated Press account, two teenagers, one 15, the other 16, went to a party at the home of Officer Brian Bauk in February, where they were provided with vodka and beer and shown pornographic videos. Bauk was charged last week with disseminating matter harmful to juveniles, contributing to the delinquency of a minor, and giving alcohol or liquor to a minor. He has been suspended from his assignment at a local school. A Nassau County, Florida sheriff's deputy who held his children hostage for 4 hours during a standoff with the police was sentenced to 5 years of probation this week. WTLV reports that Deputy Sam Lucero must also spend 1 month as an inpatient and 6 months as an outpatient at a psychiatric facility in Colorado. He has also been ordered not to have any contact with his wife and children until given permission to do so by a judge. A police officer in Miami, Florida, who was convicted of attempting to steal money from undercover agents who he thought were drug dealers, was sentenced to 10 years in prison this week. The South Florida Sun-Sentinel reports that Officer Wiebert Celestin stole $22,000 from an undercover officer who was posing as a drug dealer on October 16, 2000. Celestin arrived at the scene in uniform, despite the fact that he was not on duty at the time of the incident. In March, a jury convicted the officer on charges of grand theft, conspiracy to commit grand theft, and 3 counts of official misconduct. In addition to his 10 years of jail time, Celestin must also serve 5 years of probation and pay restitution of over $7,000 to the city of Miami. A sheriff's deputy in Orange County, Florida, who lost his job when he was arrested for identity theft, has been accused of the same crime again. WFTV reports that Marvin Cavender was arrested 4 years ago and fired from his job as a sheriff's deputy after he used his ex-wife's social security number to fraudulently obtain credit cards. Last week, she claimed that he had recently opened 13 new accounts in her name. A police officer in Lumberton, North Carolina, was sentenced to more than 4 years in prison this week for planting evidence at a suspect's home and then lying about it to investigators. An Associated Press report says that Officer Leon Oxendine was convicted in September on charges of witness tampering, making false statements to the FBI, and 5 counts of lying to a federal grand jury. According to testimony from his trial, Oxendine planted a computer disk in the home of a man who was suspected of selling drugs. He was sentenced to serve 4 years and 3 months in prison, 3 years of supervised release, and must pay a fine of $10,000. In Leyland, North Carolina, the officer in charge of the police SWAT team has been arrested on drug charges. A report from WECT says that Officer Brett Hobbs turned himself in to State Bureau of Investigation agents last Thursday after he was accused of making and selling crack cocaine and lying to authorities. Hobbs is being held at a prison in Raleigh for his own protection. His bond has been set at $500,000, and he's facing a minimum mandatory sentence of 14 years if he is convicted. The officer is also the son of Leyland Mayor Gordon Hobbs. The Leyland Police Department has placed the officer on paid leave. A Milwaukee, Wisconsin police officer who appealed his October termination was disappointed to learn this week that the decision to fire him was upheld. A report in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel says that Officer Andrew Gebhardt was accused of tobogganing, bowling, making a prank phone call to 911, and visiting an illegal after-hours bar, all acts he is alleged to have committed while on the job. In October, he became one of the 11 police officers to be fired by the new Milwaukee chief, who has only been on the job for just over 1 year. Gebhardt appealed his termination, arguing at one point that unlike the other fired Milwaukee officers, he had not been accused of beating or raping anyone. But this week, the Police and Fire Commission upheld that decision. Speaking of which, another Milwaukee police officer was fired this week for refusing to answer questions related to the brutal October beating of a visible minority man by a gang of more than a dozen white police officers at a party at the home of one of the officers. According to an Associated Press report, Officer John Clousing was fired last Thursday for refusing to obey a command from a superior officer. He is also facing internal charges of breaking state law, lying, and failing to report information to the department about the beating incident. He was one of 13 officers facing a total of 79 department charges in connection with the beating. Discipline for the other officers has not been decided yet. Clousing is also currently under investigation for using excessive force against a woman on March 3rd while he was on duty. A third Milwaukee police officer was fired this week for reasons that have not yet been made public. A man is suing the Milwaukee Police Department and the city after being beaten by Milwaukee police last July. WISN reports that the man, a soldier on leave from duty in Iraq, was beaten by police while he was handcuffed. A press conference was held by the man's family and lawyers last Thursday. Milwaukee police are not commenting on the lawsuit. A report in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported this week that taxpayers in that city have paid nearly $500,000 in wages over the past 16 months to police officers who were or remain suspended with pay or fired. A Wisconsin state law, which applies only to the Milwaukee Police Department, says that officers who are fired by the department are to be paid until their appeals process has been exhausted. A police officer in Appleton, Wisconsin, pleaded guilty last Friday to sexually assaulting two young boys. The Associated Press says that Officer Gerald Polson was originally facing 22 charges, but pleaded guilty to 6 in a deal to have the remaining charges dropped. Polson was accused of sexually assaulting two young boys, aged 15 and 16, one of whom was a student at the school where the officer worked. He was reported to police by his brother, who viewed a videotape which was part of a box of items which the officer had asked his brother to destroy. The videotape, which will be seen by the jury, which will be making a decision regarding sentencing, depicted sex acts which took place between the officer and one of his two victims. He will be sentenced on July 12th on 5 counts of second-degree sexual assault and 1 count of sexual exploitation of a child. Polson faces 212 years in prison if convicted on his charges. A police officer in Baltimore, Maryland, was sentenced on Monday to 1 year of probation after being found guilty of insurance fraud. WBAL reports that Officer Elijah Stevens applied to have his vehicle insured the day after it was involved in an accident. He then convinced one of his fellow officers to produce a false accident report stating that the accident took place after the vehicle was insured. That officer admitted to his part in the fraud when questioned. Stevens was sentenced to 2 years in prison, but that sentence was suspended by the judge in favor of 1 year of probation. An assistant police chief in San Angelo, Texas, has been demoted after he was accused of handcuffing a woman who had refused to perform a sex act on him or a female federal agent who was also present. The Associated Press reports that Officer Ron Dooley has been suspended with pay while the accusations against him are investigated. No criminal charges have been filed against the officer, who says that he handcuffed the woman because she became upset and uncontrollable after spending time in a hot tub with Dooley and the federal agent. Next up, we'll have a quick review of this week's Taser News.
As he come in, sat down in front of a mirror, was talking to himself. He was politely asked to leave. He kept talking to himself. Then the police came in.
A lot of the people who die after they've been tasered have been on cocaine, and the majority of the deaths so far, I don't know about the most recent one, the other deaths, the person who died has been on cocaine and in fact has died of the cocaine rather than the taser.
Why won't police forces, why won't government take steps to ensure that an independent expert study is carried out, which would be one way to look at that question. Is there a link?
Last Friday, a man in Miami, Florida, died hours after being shocked with a taser by police. A man in Moncton, New Brunswick, is dead after he was shot by a police taser outside of a bar last Thursday. An inmate at a prison in New Orleans, Louisiana, died last Thursday after being shocked with a taser while placed in a restraint chair. An autopsy has been ordered. A man in Houston, Texas, was hospitalized last Wednesday when he lost consciousness after being shot with a taser by police there. An 18-year-old charged with breach of peace claims that he was shocked 8 times by police in Jacksonville, Florida, last week. The police say they only shocked the teenager 2 times, but he is reported to have a number of burns on his body which would be consistent with being tasered many more times. In November, a pregnant woman in Seattle, Washington, was shocked with a taser by a police officer after she refused to sign a speeding ticket she got while driving her son to school. This week, she was found guilty of refusing to obey an officer. The police board in Kansas City, Missouri, has placed new restrictions on when police there can use tasers. Police can now only use the devices when a suspect is actively resisting them. Failure to heed the commands of an officer is no longer an adequate reason to use a stun gun. Tasers became a matter of concern to the citizens of Kansas City when police used a taser to subdue a 66-year-old woman who was using her car horn inappropriately. All police agencies in Brevard County, Florida, have agreed to new taser use guidelines. The new rules would prevent the use of tasers except in cases where a suspect poses a physical threat to an officer. Taser use for noncompliance will no longer be acceptable. In San Jose, California, the Coalition for Justice and Accountability is calling for a ban on taser use after the death of a Vietnamese woman who was tasered by police there. In San Jose, every police officer carries a taser. The police chief there has no plans to stop using the weapons or to restrict their use in any way. Other than the killings already reported in this program, police also killed people this week in Branson, Montana, Bradley Beach, New Jersey, Modesto, California, where police have killed now 9 people since the year 2000, Vancouver, Washington, Long Beach, California, Corona, California, Whitby, Ontario, Tyler, Texas, Washington, D.C., Mandeville, Louisiana, and after 22 years without a police-involved shooting, police in Cambridge, Maryland, killed 2 people last week in unrelated incidents. Minsook Lee is the writer and director of Hogtown, The Politics of Policing, a new documentary film which takes a close look at a 6-month period in 2004 which culminated in the approval by City Council of the largest annual increase in police spending in the history of the City of Toronto. The film takes a behind-the-scenes look at the Toronto Police Services Board's attempts to account for increased spending and the attempts by former Toronto Police Chief Julian Fantino to manipulate the budget process. Stuart Andrews spoke with Minsook Lee on the CKLN program Frameline last week.
Well, I've always been interested in Toronto politics, local politics, and I had just done a documentary about migrant workers in Canada, El Contrato. And after completing that, I wanted to do a documentary about my own backyard, so to speak, about politics in Toronto. And it was a good time to be thinking about Toronto because Toronto went through a regime change. When I started developing this project in 2003, there were municipal elections. And so Mayor David Miller came into power, and I thought about City Hall, and I thought, well, when there's a power transition, what happens? How do things change? And how does that affect, you know, different camps, and how do people negotiate power? But also I wanted to bring the camera to City Hall so that people paid attention to what was going on. It seemed to me that oftentimes what goes on at City Hall takes place under the radar. people don't pay attention, and there are some fairly pivotal decisions being made. And I guess the irony about local government is that people don't pay attention to it, but the services provided by municipal government affect our lives on a regular and more daily basis than the services, for example, provided by provincial or federal levels of government. So I guess those are the two reasons why I was interested in doing a documentary about City Hall. And originally, I didn't know what the issue would be that would crop up and drive, be the sort of the narrative train for this documentary. But I knew that if you land at City Hall at this period of time, something's going to come up that will bring all the different forces out in play. And within a few weeks of shooting, policing became the issue.
Well, that's interesting because definitely as the documentary unfolds, there is a kind of a narrative thread that develops, and in fact, and subplots and various characters kind of jump out of the background, and you focus in on their particular situation and their plight. And there's some very compelling dramatic moments. Can you talk about the process as you're filming this, like how you decided what people to kind of focus in on, what aspects of the issues to focus in on, or was this a decision that you made in the editing room after the fact?
No, you make definitely you're making that decision as you're shooting. I had 30 shooting days spread out over a period of 6 months. Mm-hmm. But as I said, when I started, it was City Hall, and I had a few different city councilors in mind who I knew were generally very active on some key issues that might be the ones that would flare up. So I had identified some key city council sort of figures and people who I also knew would be really engaging on camera. But then as soon as the issue of policing and guns and gangs and violence and the police services board all started sort of taking center stage, in many ways the actions directed this film. I followed the actions as they unfolded and stayed with the central characters who were pivotal to what was going on. And the sort of the narrative thread fleshed itself out as I'm shooting. So, and it's a Verite documentary, so you shoot a lot of tape. And but focusing and thinking through that, you know, just stay with the story, stay with the full context of the story, make sure that you're able to capture it, sort of a 360 degree on the story.
Well, let's actually explain for people what the story is that you managed to capture.
Okay, Hogtown, The Politics of Policing, is a Verite documentary that looks at how political pressures impact politicians and how politics affects policing in our city, in the city of Toronto. And it was shot during a six-month period of time in which policing became very central to the city on a number of fronts. One, there were a series of shootings in the city, in the streets, where people then were reacting to that and felt that there has to be some kind of citywide solutions, or there has to be some kind of thinking through on what's going on with the shootings in the streets of Toronto. So there was an environment in which many people were talking about the recent flare-up of shootings on the streets, and people were talking from different ranges. Some people were talking about, you know, guns and gangs, more cops, we need more cops and more money to the cops. And then other people were saying, well, you know, community services have been so defunded that it's not a surprise, like, look at the bigger picture. And this kind of polarization and different solutions towards a very critical problem in our city is what my camera captured. But then, and it's interesting about the guns and the shooting in the city, in that our homicide rate and our violent crime rate has gone down. We're one of the safest cities in North America and in the world. But shootings, when they occur, they seize the headline. People get very scared, and then there can be and often there is an attitude where, you know, more law and order, more cops in the street. But there's also, my film gives you an opportunity to see a bigger picture, and the policing is the largest budget item in the city of Toronto. We spend more on policing than we do on fire and ambulances, than on parks and recreation, senior services, children's services combined. So policing is a significant part of the city's budget. And right after the shootings flared up, and I was looking at a city councilor who was trying to deal with how to negotiate the city's response and then the mayor's response, looking at all that kind of back and forth, the City of Toronto had to approve a budget. And because policing is the biggest line item in the budget, it was very interesting to see how that budget got approved. And the Police Services Board is the civilian body that is mandated to govern policing. They approved the budget, but during the time that I was shooting, this board was split. There were two very identifiable camps, one that was talking about transparency and accountability and looking at the police budget in the context of overall city spending, and another camp that saw police critics as being anti-cop. And the division within the Police Services Board was a very big part of Hogtown's story, because the chair of the Police Services Board, for example, was a target of a media smear. An internal police memo was leaked to the media that suggested the chair of the Police Services Board was sympathetic to pedophiles. Now, this media smear happened just during the time when the police board was looking at the budget and debating it. And the chair of the police board was identified as being on the camp of people who were talking about more scrutiny, more transparency, more accountability when it came to policing. So Hogtown followed the whole budget process, the tug of war around that. And there was an environment of a lot of acrimony, and certain Police Services Board members talked about feeling intimidated or that they were concerned about being surveilled. That whole environment is captured in Hogtown. And then in the midst of shooting, the largest police corruption scandal in Canadian history flared up. And two sons of the former chief of police of Toronto, of a former chief of police, were charged, one with Police Service Act violations and another one with criminal charges. In total, I think in 2004, just over 20 police officers were charged with various offenses. And during the time of my shooting, a series of these charges hit the headlines. So then the camera captured the time when the Police Services Board had to develop a response. And citizens were asking, you know, what's going on with police and who are the police overseers and when is there any governance of policing? And these kinds of questions that really test the mettle of democracy. And finally, sort of at the end of my process of shooting, the police chief at the time, Julian Fantino, his contract was not renewed. And when the Police Services Board, which makes that decision, announced that decision, that kicked off a firestorm of a political debate, both on council floor but also in the streets of Toronto. And it was very interesting to see how that debate was languaged and how people took sides on that and how it became very politicized. That in a nutshell is Hogtown.
There's a few things. One of the interesting things about it is you actually do expose and shed light on the political process, the interrelationship between the Police Services Board and the City Council and the Police Department. Could you kind of explain how all those entities kind of function together? I mean, what is the exact role of the Police Services Board?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think a lot of people know about policing. They know who our mayor is and who the chief of police is. But in terms of the Police Services Board, they have a lot of power. They're a civilian body, and they're mandated to set police policy. And they also approve the police budget, and they hire and fire the senior staff and police services. So, for example, the chief of police. Now, the board is made up of civilian appointees, and then it's also made up of politicians who are nominated by their fellow colleagues on city council. And so you've got a 7-member board. So for a board with a fair amount of power, what I found during my time of shooting was that this board was in a lot of trouble. There was dysfunction within the board, acrimony and internal conflicts, but also the history of the board was such that it didn't necessarily exercise its given mandate to the best of its ability that I think a lot of community organizations wanted it to. And it does bring up a few questions. I mean, policing is such a key issue in any democracy, and you need a separation from police and state. And you need governance of policing. If we lived in a utopia, then you wouldn't need governance of policing. But frankly, we're all human, and people make mistakes, and there has to be some kind of independent, accountable system that makes police accountable to civilian oversight. But what has happened in the past, and what my cameras captured when I was shooting, was that sometimes civilian oversight isn't exercised to the best of its ability, and when it is exercised, it's challenged and seen as being anti-cop. So I think the Police Services Board and how it runs, watching it, monitoring it, paying attention to it, is very key to making sure that the city is a healthy city and, you know, the democracy that we live in actually functions.
Well, that's another question I had for you. After spending so much time up close in a lot of these meetings, and in fact you were allowed access to meetings where other media were asked to withdraw from. What's your overall impression about the process? I mean, what do you think are some of its strengths or perhaps its inherent failings?
I think that there's a lot of ways in which the Police Services Board and which civilian governance can be re-envisioned, reimagined, and it really needs the input, the committed input of civilians and citizens and community organizations, because if we just leave it up to politicians and judges and sort of, if we leave it up to the group that's been authoring it to date through most of the history of the city and the province and this country, I think we're not going to have a policing policy that's representative of the realities of today. Toronto is definitely one of the most diverse cities in the world. We all know that. And yet we had a chief of police who, during his five-year term, refused to acknowledge racial profiling was an issue. And it came after the fact, it came out that senior members of his police force, African-Canadian members who were police themselves, had a meeting, a private meeting with the then chief, Julian Santino, and talked to him about racial profiling. And despite that meeting even, there was never a public acknowledgement. And I think we're talking about different kinds of policing or different schools of policing and making sure that we have a policy of how police is policing, you know, is exercised and how it functions with the rest of the city. It's not in isolation. You know, seeing policing separate from community services or education or all the other sort of, you know, parts of the rainbow that make up sort of municipal services is a real danger, I think. So I think that one thing is the Police Services Board needs more attention from people to get engaged and involved in. The board itself is, you know, reportedly looking at community input and asking for it. So, for example, right now in the province of Ontario, we've got a provincial government that's talking about overhauling the police complaint system. Currently, there is no independent body that reviews complaints against police. So if you have a complaint against police, you have to go to the police station where the officer who you might be complaining against works out of. Now, a lot of people have commented that that's intimidating, that in fact people find that it's not an accountable system, and we need a body that's separate from, so the police aren't policing themselves and they're not investigating themselves. Now, it's been about, I think, just over 10 years that we have not had an independent body reviewing police complaints. And there was one, but that was shut down and changed when Mike Harris was in power at Queen's Park. And now we have an opportunity with the current provincial government who's talking about overhauling it and redesigning it. Well, I think it's an opportunity for people to give input and ideas and contact their Queen's Park Member of Parliament and the City Councillor and the Police Services Board and say, you know, these are some ideas of how, these are alternative community-based ideas.
I think really one of the most compelling aspects of the film are the characters that you somewhat get to become familiar with, and some of the city councillors, some of the really right-wing 905 city councillors, and some of the more left-leaning Police Services Board members, and their interrelationships, and it's very volatile. People may be surprised to see how impassioned and confrontational some of these people are. There's some really tense moments in the film, and I was wondering if you could kind of talk about some of the characters in the film that you think are most memorable and exactly why you think they are memorable.
Well, I chose City Council to follow local politics because I feel that local politics is one of the most dynamic, engaging, and accessible levels of government that people can get involved in, neighborhoods and community-based organizations. And one of the reasons is that City Council, Toronto City Council, we've got 44 city councillors and one mayor. Now, we have a weak mayor system, and that means essentially that the mayor doesn't have a lot of power on paper. The mayor has to lead by moral suasion, so to speak. The mayor has to provide, he or she has to provide a sense of vision that councillors can buy into. Now, formally on paper, there's also no party system at City Council. You've got 44 independents. So unlike Ottawa or Queen's Park, where the party system sets a lot of discipline and does shut down or restrict the kind of debate or discussion, what you have at Toronto local politics at City Council is 44 independents and a mayor, weak mayor system, and all kinds of unpredictable things that could happen that aren't necessarily managed as strictly as they do in the upper levels of government. And in some ways, it's this big dysfunctional family that at times can succeed and get things achieved and other times don't, and sparks fly. And I think the part about local politics that's so interesting is that people's engagement in it is fairly low. Voter turnout is about 35%, I believe, and it can be a bit lower than that. So if city councillors are voted in with not a huge demographic chunk of their ward actually even voting these people in. And yet they do make decisions about policing or about development in the city, and really critical decisions that affect your and my life. So that sort of disproportionate balance of the reality at City Council was really attractive to me. And City Council does attract, and I think it's sort of an incubator for really interesting personalities that aren't shut down by a party whip. So I think, in fact, theoretically, all 44 councillors were to me equally fascinating subjects, but some of them are more flamboyant and more outspoken than others. Yeah.
Thanks to Stuart Andrews for making that interview available to us. That's all for this week's show. Tune into this station next week for more. Email your comments and story ideas to ron@ckln.fm. Thanks to everyone who sent in articles for this week's show. From CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto, I'm Ron Anisich. Each week, we end Bad Cop No Donut with a song. This week, it's Till the Pigs Come Round by the Subhumans.
Come round.